I guess we should get started. I'm sure, hopefully a few other people will be straggling in. So welcome and thank you for coming to this panel on media criticism. I'm Curtis Brainerd. I'm the science news editor at Columbia Journalism Review, media magazine that's based up at Columbia University in New York. And I wanted to organize this panel about media criticism for two reasons. The first being to introduce some of the journalists and others in the audience to a few of the folks that are out there bird-dogging their work and to introduce them to the processes that these guys use in that effort. And the second reason is because I wanted to offer a little bit of perspective from our, as one of my colleagues put it, from our 1,000-foot view of some of the goods and the bads in the world of science journalism right now, and also some of the opportunities and challenges facing science journalists out there in the world today. And we have an excellent panel that's very well equipped to do that. But before I introduce them, let me just take a moment to tell you a little bit more about what I do, because I think it offers one example of why media criticism matters, and it's also a little bit of an interesting story about how I got into this racket, because I kind of just stumbled into it, and we'll hear from the others about how they got into this business as well. But I was a student at Columbia, Columbia Journalism School, back in 2005, 2006, and I got into it because I was enrolled in a class at the journalism school that I ended up not really enjoying. It was a magazine production class. I didn't really care how a magazine was put together. I just wanted to write for one, you know. So I pulled out of this class, and I needed to make up some extra credits, and all of the ones, all the classes that I wanted to take were full. So I asked a mentor of mine, a professor there, if I could write a few articles for him over the course of the semester. And he, in turn, said, you know, why don't you go down to talk to my good friend, the executive editor at CJR, who's been looking for somebody to begin parsing and analyzing all of this climate coverage that we're starting to see. This was the fall of 2006, so, you know, around the time of Hurricane Katrina and Inconvenient Truth, people were starting to anticipate the release of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's Fourth Assessment Report in 2007. So climate coverage is really hitting its zenith, and this is very clear if you look back at some of the studies that have tracked the levels of climate coverage. It was at an all-time high back in 2007. So I went down and talked to the editor at CJR, and he said, sure, you know, why don't you start writing a few columns over the course of the semester? And this is, you know, kind of getting to the point why I think media criticism matters. We just had such a great reaction to my work, really positive from the journalism community and the scientific community alike. You guys might remember a phrase that was kind of hot back then called balances bias. This continues to be an issue in the media today, although in different kind of circumstances. But this was the idea that, you know, back in 2006, climate reporters were still really didn't know, you know, to what extent they should be quoting climate change. I like the word contrarians. Others call them skeptics, deniers. It was a big issue back then. And so that's, you know, really what I started attacking in my first few columns for CJR as a student. And instantly we started hearing back from journalists and scientists, you know, who were thanking us for offering pointers about how to cover the subject properly, and from scientists who were thanking us for correcting the records. So we were clearly scratching an itch that was irritating the industry. So before I graduated, CJR offered me a job, and the rest is sort of history. About a year later, we launched formally The Observatory, which is our online science news desk. And there I do a mix of media criticism and media reporting, covering everything from the general sciences to environmental sciences and biomedical sciences. But what was wonderful was that around the same time, I started to see maybe explosion isn't the right word, but a certain proliferation in the amount of media criticism. Very quickly after I started doing this, the Night Science Journalism Tracker was launched. We have a couple representatives from that site here today. The Yale Forum on Climate Change in the Media. And then even before I got started, there was a great site, which I'll talk about a little bit later, called Health News Review. So, and then, you know, on top of that, you just started to see a lot of bloggers getting into the media criticism business. I mean, this is one of the central occupations of blogs is analyzing the media out there. And so I think the web really kind of tapped into this unfulfilled desire out there for a bit of analysis, a bit of guidance, some aggregation. There are all kinds of elements to media criticism and reporting. And I think, you know, it kind of stands to reason. You know, every day, you know, millions of Americans begin their days by reading the paper and griping about the news. I mean, people love to gripe about the news. So that's what we get paid to do professionally. and it's very rewarding. So with that said, let me I'll introduce these panelists in turn, and they'll tell you a little bit about how they got into this business, about what they do and the strategies that they employ. All of them also have very interesting ancillary activities in academia and consulting capacities and various positions, so I'll ask them to go over a bit of those as well. And we'll kick things off.
We have to do all that in 4 minutes? That's all right.
Well, you know, how long did I take? I probably went a little over 4 minutes, so if I'm leading by example, go ahead and feel free to take that amount of time. So we'll start with Bud Ward, the founder and editor of the Yale Forum on Climate Change in the Media, longtime journalist and educator and co-founder of the Society of Environmental Journalists. Bud?
Thanks, Curtis. Nice to be here. We started the Yale Forum on Climate Change and Media 4 years ago this month, and it actually was a product of a series of workshops that had been funded by National Science Foundation to bring climate scientists and journalists together to better understand each other's culture, each other's modus operandi, their discipline. And we had run a series of those across the country. As a matter of fact, Curtis was a student at the time. He attended our workshop at Columbia University at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. Mm-hmm. Paul, at that time, I think had left Business Week, may have been with AP, may have left AP, but Paul attended the workshop we did in, at Scripps Institution in La Jolla, and Bill Kovarik in the back of the room, by the way, whose birthday is today.
That was tough, secret.
It was Lisa's birthday yesterday.
Nobody brought cupcakes.
No. Should have seen it.
Bill actually attended the one also at Columbia, Lamont Doherty. It was a blast. So we started it back then, and climate change at that point was the hot issue, as Curtis kind of touched on. It really was the big issue, this false balance, balance as accuracy and whatever what you want to call it, really was a pervasive concern. I don't think the Yale Forum does much media criticism per se. I don't think we do as much as I sometimes wish we did do. What we do is we carry original reporting by freelancers around the country, basically. And I know Chris Woodside is here. Chris is one of our regular writers for the Yale Forum. So we carry regular articles that we think the media and scientists should be interested in. Our angle is communication. It's a communication on climate science issues. And it's not media narrowly defined. It's media extremely broadly defined. So we're interested in how Dead Tree Media cover the issues. We're interested in how the wire service, I almost said wire services, how the wire service covers, and wire service kind of, cover climate change issues. But we're also interested in how Broadway covers it. We're interested in how South Park treats it. We're interested in how theater and drama and zoos and aquariums communicate on climate change issues. So we identify media extremely broadly. I would say that you could not start a site like ours today in the current economic climate or in the current climate involving climate. You cannot start a publication with the name Yale Forum on Climate Change and the Media today. I'm not too apologetic about that. Curtis mentioned I was a co-founder of SEJ, and in all honesty, I don't think we could start an organization named SEJ today either. We could back in 1979, 80, 81 when we did it, but I don't think we could. We would choose that name to start today. So I think I'm not too apologetic about that. As I mentioned, we cover media extremely broadly. We're interested in how South Park, how Disney Channel, how new media cover it. I think our focus has gone somewhat from how it's reported to the tools that are used in reporting on climate change. I believe it was at an SEJ conference, and I'm aging myself here, but many of you old-timers here will recognize the names Amy Guerin and Adam Glenn. I think it was at an SEJ conference where I first heard the term crowdsourcing, and I believe it was from Amy. It could well have been from Adam. But we're interested in crowdsourcing as a tool on covering climate change issues and communication issues. So we're interested in the tools that are that apply also now. I personally have trouble defining what journalism is and where it's going. And from my historic context, my kind of ink in the veins context, journalism has obviously changed a lot. So the media that we're interested in following in the Yale Forum extends to a number of sites, again, related to climate change, but I'll just tell you a couple of them. Skeptical Science out of Brisbane, Australia, spectacular site. We follow What's Up With That, the Anthony Watts Skeptics site. The Huffington Post, Matt Drudge, Real Climate, The Conversation. If you're not aware of The Conversation, check it out. It's theconversation.edu.au, a spectacular marriage of science and journalism.
Can you give me that?
Theconversation.edu.au, a spectacular site, bringing together scientists and journalists in a common pursuit of communicating climate. Another great invention from down under, if you will. So we cover climate progress. We, of course, look at Dot Earth, Redkin site, Ecocentric, the Walsh site from Time magazine, Mark Morano's missives. And I credit Mark. You know, Mark is the only one who can send an email and make me feel dirty. They think it's a cool medium, email. But Mark actually makes me feel dirty when I open and read his emails. So it's amazing what he's done to the two emails. So, you know, those are among the sites we kind of like to track. I'll finish by saying we do like to look at ethics issues, and that's an area where I have enormous concerns as the new media come forward. A good colleague, a good friend, a great reporter, John Carey from Business Week, recently wrote a piece on climate and weather in Scientific American. It was funded by the Pew Center for Climate Change. It's certainly a very reputable organization, but John went through the usual process of having his copy cleared by the Pew Center staff prior to publication in Scientific American. That kind of thing didn't used to happen. It may now be acceptable. I still have a little bit of trouble reconciling that as being old-line journalism. I'll finish with one quick quote. I don't know if I'm allowed to do this. I'm going to quote from an SEJ listserv. So many of you might have seen this. This kind of thing didn't happen in the old ink in the veins journalism. I quote, as an individual versus a journalist, in quotes, as an individual versus a journalist, I went to Washington during the protests at the White House on the Keystone Pipeline. I was one of the people arrested, along with 1,200 others. If anyone is doing a story on Keystone and wants a firsthand observation or quote, contact me offline. Well, that's real interesting to me for a journalist to become a protester and then go back and put on the journalist hat the next day. That didn't used to happen. In a lot of places, it couldn't happen. I'm not sure it should. Anyway, those are the kind of things we're interested in.
Can I use your timer? Can you set that to...
It didn't work for me.
It didn't. I spoke for 38 minutes.
You guys are doing great. No. Journalists need to work by an internal clock, right? You know exactly when you've got enough time to finish that piece and make your deadline. Okay, thanks, Bud. We'll turn now to Paul Rayburn from the Night Science Journalism Tracker, former science editor and writer for Business Week and the Associated Press, who actually wrote a couple columns for me before the tracker snatched them away. So take it away, Paul.
Okay. So I just tell you briefly about the tracker. The URL is ksjtracker.mit.edu. I'm pretty sure if you Google Night Science Journalism Tracker, it'll come up. And we have a lot of, science, medicine, environmental stuff, all of that. Charlie Pettit, formerly of U.S. News and the San Francisco Chronicle, is sort of the chief tracker, and he does most of the environmental posting. I do mostly medical and genetics and genomics and so forth. But a lot of the issues, as you know, cross over whatever the field of journalism is, particularly if it's in the science environment medical area. So I'd urge you to take a look. We're proud of what we do there, and I think we try to make a contribution. We have a lot of exchange with Curtis and retweeting and various things, and it try to engender a conversation more broadly than just on our site. So please take a look if you're interested. I think there are a couple of things. I should just briefly, I think it was, you probably know better than I do, it started about 5 or 6 years ago. I've been involved for about 2 or 3 years. Anyway, something like that. Supported by the Knight Foundation, which also supports the science journalism fellowships at MIT. So there are issues. We won't have time. When we get in the questions, we can talk about being a journalist for a foundation, which is an increasingly common thing, as you know. I'd be happy to give you my thoughts on that. So let me just tell you, since we don't have a whole lot of time, and I'm eager to get to the questions too, a couple of things. We had Charlie Pettit had a post yesterday. You may have seen the story, or if you were here, you might not have seen the story, about Richard Muller, who's a physicist at UC Berkeley, who has not been involved in climate, but is sort of a casual, offhand skeptic. You know, like, if I ever looked into this, I bet I'd find out it's not so simple as all those climate guys say. And so, through some sort of circumstances, he got involved in doing a study, which I thought, number one, was interesting. So many of the skeptics are people who've never done a study. Even if, like Richard Lindzen at MIT, they have expertise in the area, they've never done a study. I'm waiting for one of those people to do a climate model that shows temperatures are going to go down over the next 50 years. You won't find that. So in any case, Muller was one of those kind of guys who actually did a study, and he took the data that people like Jim Hansen have used, and all this stuff is available, and went through the whole thing and actually came up with findings that were slightly, basically similar to the kind of findings Hansen and company have come up with, if anything, a little bit scarier. And so here was a skeptic who took a look at the data and said, well, you know, now that I've taken a look, I'm not a skeptic anymore. So Charlie did a post on that for the Tracker, which if you take a look at it, he not only talked about the issues, Charlie's covered science in San Francisco for a long time, he knew Muller, made a couple of remarks, sorry, I looked at the timer, I completely lost my train of thought. Anyway, so he summed up a lot of the articles that were written about this. So you can see about, you know, links to eight or ten articles. So it's a nice way to get a different kind of look at a news story. In fact, if you're writing a story about some of these things, you might want to take a look at the Tracker, because he's already found a lot of what other people have done for you, or I try to do the same thing too. But I'll tell you one story, one war story, only one, about being a media critic. Here's the downside of being a media critic. Last week, I was at the Science Writers meeting in Arizona last weekend, and there was a session on covering scientific controversies, and sure enough, two of the four panelists were people I had more or less excoriated on the Tracker for their stories. So the moderator asked me if I would come to the session, which I desperately did not want to do, but I thought I should go and stand up for my work, and I did. And not only that, I went up to the panel after the discussion and introduced myself to the people who were polite. Nobody punched me or anything. So, but it is, I mean, it is interesting, because when you're criticizing media, the kind of things that we do, I'm criticizing all of us, and myself sometimes too. I try to, you know, reflect on things I've done, but it's a somewhat perilous business. And believe me when I tell you, if you make a mistake as a media critic, the people you have criticized will not be shy about pointing out that you have made a mistake. I'm over time. I'll tell a story very quickly. The first few months I was on the Tracker, the New York Times had a front page story about the football concussion stuff and brain injury and long-term damage and all of that stuff. They had a guy, I don't know if he's still there, but they had hired a guy, Alan Schwartz, to cover that story. So, in short, the science for what they were reporting was flaky. It was a telephone survey, you know, like they call football players up and say, you having any problems, you know, and compile these answers and try to make some kind of statistical substance out of it. And it was on the front page of the Times. So I wrote a very strong story saying, this shouldn't have been worth more than a brief mention of anything, and definitely should have not have been on the front page. And I went through to look for the author of this quote-unquote study, So I searched. I had the webpage up, and I searched for the guy's name, and it didn't come up. And I thought, Jesus, they didn't even talk to the guy who wrote the study. So I wrote that. You know, not they did not. You know, of course. Then I found out when the phone calls started coming in from the sports editor at the Times and all these people that in fact my browser search is case sensitive, and I put the guy's name in with lowercase letters, and yes, indeed, they had mentioned the guy. In the study. So I had backpedaled left, right, and unfortunately, my point, which was valid, that it was a study that shouldn't have been on the front page, was completely ruined by my own mistake. So if you tread into media criticism, be very careful. Watch your case-sensitive searches, because it's a, and it's, you know, on a slightly more serious note, you know, you lose your point if you do that. And we do think, I think all of us and maybe some of you think this kind of self-examination is an important thing, so it's important to be careful and to do it well. So I'm over top.
Great, thanks, Paul. Yeah, and absolutely. When you're the one watchdogging the media, you got to take the time to do it right and make sure that you've checked all your facts.
It's the only mistake I ever made in 20 years of doing this.
Sure. All right. Thanks. So we'll go now to Pere Estepinha, who is also with the Science Journalism Tracker, and he does the Spanish language tracking there. He's also a blogger for El País and a consultant for the Inter-American Development Bank in the field of science journalism, among a number of other roles. So,
yeah, okay, thank you. My background, in fact, is not in journalism. So I'm doing criticism in journalism with a background in science, in biochemistry. That's kind of weird, no? But I've been working in the field for 10 years. I was first in a TV program in Spain, then I grew up to El País, other newspapers, and I got this Night Science Journalism Fellowship in 2007-2008. And I remember when Boyce, the former director, asked me, is anyone doing some media criticism in the Spanish-speaking world? And I said, not that I know. And then I tried to check online if somebody was doing, and there were small things in Barcelona, but nobody was doing anything similar to the Night Tracker when in Spanish. He thought that could be a good idea to have the Spanish language track. I would like to do it. And I said, I don't know, because I don't like to criticize. I really like to find my own stories and write the stories. It's what I really like. But then I think I will try, no? And I discovered that this is a very important function I think it has for the Spanish-speaking world. I would say that the criticism that I'm doing is a slight criticism. Probably when I'm tracking stories about Spain, I'm more critic in the sense. But what I really like to do with the Latin American world, it's Latin American is very big, and there's a lot of differences between Argentina or Bolivia regarding to journalism, and we can discuss about that, no? And especially about environment journalism also. It's very diverse. What I really like to do is to encourage people to somehow make like a network. It's like a site. Probably it's only the site that connects different dots from journalists in Latin America doing this kind of job. Regarding specifically to environment, some things that are shocking to me. For example, when they talk about climate change, they talk about mitigation. It's changing. But at the beginning, I saw they talking a lot about mitigation, when the problem in Latin America is not mitigation, it's adaptation. It's the U.S., Europe, China, they need to be worried about mitigation, the climate change. In Central America, reporters need to complain about, hey, what's going on here? What will we do to solve this problem that all scientists are telling us that we will have, no? And there are also big differences in the issue of genetic modified organisms. It's not the same, the approach that someone from Paraguay has, that someone from Peru or from Mexico. And you see, even inside the same country, in Mexico especially, some newspapers that are clearly against, complaining constantly about genetic modified organisms, and others that are more supportive. No? So I like to do this kind of comparison. And then to explain the stories, I always say that the Amazon is more interesting than the universe, but it doesn't have the communications office of NASA. Well, there are it's true. There's plenty of stories. I've been in the Amazon a few times, and there are a lot of stories that are untold. And when I see as environmental or science reporter from those countries talking about the blue velvet worm, that said, oh, if Carl Zimmer was here, I would write a great story for the New York Times. So I like to point these very nice stories. I'm doing criticism. For example, last week I was writing about the in Costa Rica about stem cell clinics that's doing some claims that are not reliable at all, and La Nación, it's the biggest newspaper, was giving credit to that, so you don't have to give credit to those claims. What I really like to do is to find these stories that are untold in Yasuni, for example. Everybody should know that in Yasuni there is this controversy of saving the forest or extracting the petrol, and the government is not doing very well, or it's a strange the position that they are taking. So there are plenty of things that we can discuss afterwards, if you want. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Per. And I just want to take a minute to mention the site I discussed earlier, the healthnewsreview.org. This is also a site that you all should check out. I was actually really hoping to have the site's founder and director, Gary Schweitzer, attend the panel, but unfortunately he couldn't make it, so I'll just say a few words about it in his stead. It's actually been around since, 2005, I think. Last April, I wrote a story about Health News Review, and this kind of gets to Paul's point that we tend to, what's great about all these sites is we all kind of go about this in a different way, and it ends up being very complimentary, actually, rather than competitive. And there's, I'm highlighting things on the tracker and Health News Reviews, and likewise, they'll highlight things on CJR and the Yale Forum. So that's been great. And Gary's site, Health News Review, so as I mentioned, turned 5 years old last April. And they use a very different kind of method than the ones we all employ, which is a little bit, all of our sites are kind of a little bit more traditional in nature. Catch as catch can. It depends on what's breaking. But Health News Reviews uses a system that was based on the Media Doctor Australia site, and it's now been copied many times over. And they've got a team of about half a dozen freelancers and medical professionals who use a 10-point criteria system to evaluate articles. And for each of these 10 points, and this relates to, adequately explaining the costs of a new treatment or procedure, and I should mention they only cover treatments or procedures. There has to be something that's really kind of directly affecting human health. So on these 10 points, they either get a satisfactory or an unsatisfactory mark. And then depending on how many of those are satisfactory or unsatisfactory, each article is ranked on a scale of 0 to 5 stars. So it's really kind of an interesting, well-defined system. And when I wrote about Health News Review last April on its fifth anniversary, they had reviewed almost 1,500 articles. Very interesting. They're really quite prolific. And unfortunately, found that on balance, the media was not doing very well with these health medical stories. I think fully two-thirds had received mostly unsatisfactory remarks in those 10 categories that I mentioned. And they tended to get the worst grades in the most important categories, explaining the evidence, explaining the costs, the benefits, the potential harms, that kind of thing. And they were getting better grades in some of the less important categories, mentioning alternative treatments and stuff. Not that that isn't important, but they were really struggling with some of the central points. So it's a great site. It's now this same system, which I mentioned started with the Media Doctor Australia site, has now spun out into sister sites in Media Doctor Canada, Media Doctor Hong Kong, Media Doctor Germany, and Japan, I believe. There's a whole suite of them out there, so I really recommend that you guys check those out. Health News Review is supported by the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision Making, so it really has a lot of expertise behind it as well. It's really a top-notch site. So with that, we'll kind of get in questions here, and I'll go ahead.
I'm just going to say that there's a great opportunity there I don't think there's an environmental site like that.
No.
But that's a terrific opportunity if somebody has access to some foundation support to do that kind of thing for environmental news. It'd be terrific.
Yeah, I really love the kind of structured review process. Again, you know, we're all just kind of weighing in almost as columnists, almost as op-ed writers. I mean, again, we're putting a lot of research and work into our reviews, but having this structured system is really kind of an interesting approach.
You should say Blood's site does... some of that kind of thing, but not quite with the same.
True, yeah, but Bud's site has a bit more structure than perhaps the tracker CJR. All right, so we'll get into questions.
Can I add one detail on something Paul said?
Sure.
Paul's comment about running into the folks in Flagstaff who he had critiqued. You know, one of my problems with being a media critic, which I did in the previous incarnation on a newsletter I did called Environment Writer, you know, it's much easier to praise, to give a, in CJR terms, to give a laurel than it is to give a dart. Because you're often giving darts in this small community to folks you know, and you're going to sit down and have a drink with a couple days later. Frankly, you know, it adds an element of something to the price. So I always find that it's easier to praise somebody than to critique their work. And that's maybe one reason I don't do quite as much of it as I used to. I did do one at one time, and I was researching, I was reporting a story on a giveaway to a number of SEJ members. It ended up, it was from Anheuser-Busch, and it was from Busch Gardens. And they were giving a fairly high-priced newsletter to SEJ journalists who lived near a Busch theme park. Well, clearly they were trying to savor some good press out of those recipients. And I got wind of this, and I started researching, and I started writing about it, and all. I started calling the reporters who had accepted this gift. And most of them, you know, were a little bit shy and embarrassed that they'd done so. But one I had not called, and he learned that I was reporting this. So he called me and said, "I hear you're researching this story. I just thought I'd tell you that I accepted that gift, and do you want to talk about it?" I said, "Sure." So I wrote about it, and I wrote about that individual. It didn't really matter that Environment Writer slammed that individual and the others who we named in that article. What mattered was when CJR picked it up from us and gave it a dart. That can be career-threatening, to get a dart from CJR. At least it was then. Now, since then, and I'll finish this, since then, the person who for so many years did a great job doing darts and laurels for CJR has retired, moved on. I think, and I think a media critic should look at this, I think CJR gives a much higher percentage of laurels now than it used to. I think the old person gave a lot of darts, and they were very valuable and constructive. I think the new staff there, you can check me if I'm wrong, but I think they're leaning much more toward laurels than darts. And I cannot kind of understand it, but it's a shame in some ways.
Yeah, no, I agree, actually. And this is great. This was going to be my first question to the panel, actually, is trying to find that balance. Because, you know, the term here is media criticism. But obviously, not everything we do is critical, you know. Often, the press deserves a good flogging. But the press can get bullied, you know. The press also needs a defender at times. It's often very unfairly criticized. And I think part of our responsibility is to highlight the exceptional work out there, the reporters who really are bending over backwards trying to tell interesting stories, important stories, and get their facts right. But I would agree with Bud. We've started to lean more toward laurels recently at CJR. And I've kind of noticed even in my own work that I've started to stick up for the press a little bit more than I've been criticizing it. Again, maybe that gets back to this point where, you know, it is a bit hard. You get to know the people in the field. They become acquaintances and colleagues, sometimes friends. And, you know, it's the same issue that any reporter deals with about a certain getting too close to your sources. You know, you do need to maintain a certain distance in order to be able to analyze them critically. So that's I think, a real challenge in the industry. So I also wanted to just pick up on a point that Bud made earlier about, you know, he was saying that the Yale form really takes a broad definition of media. And I wanted to point out that not all of us do that. In fact, Health News Review only looks at a select group of publications. I think the top 25 papers by circulation. They used to do the three big networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. Now they've cut that back. They're doing MSNBC, CNN, some of the cable networks, as well as a number of top websites. But I think that's also kind of an interesting point. And at CJR, we also tend to focus on the really big-ticket media. We don't, as Bud does, pay as much attention to sites like Mark Morano's or Climate Progress or something like that, which are really kind of sites for people who are already really highly engaged and kind of in the know. But I think that's kind of another interesting facet of what we do. So since Bud's kind of already addressed my first question to the panel, maybe we should just go ahead and kick it out to the audience.
Jeff Young with the public radio program Living Art. I'm wondering, do we have enough distance from the hacked emails or ClimateGate to give an assessment of the role of some of the good, bad, ugly coverage of that
episode? You guys want to take this? Yeah, it's a bit. That was one of the big ones in the last couple of years. Sure.
I think it was one of the first real experiences of breaking news for journalists covering climate. I mean, you had a breaking story, new story every day. I think, as I recall, the first two general circulation newspaper reports on it were on a Sunday. They were both front page. So they were both below the fold in the New York Times and Washington Post. And the term took hold in those articles, ClimateGate. I think the term is editorial, judgmental, unwarranted. You know, when Lloyd Benson ran against Dan Quayle, oh boy, am I old. When Lloyd Benson ran against Dan Quayle in the vice presidential debate, Benson won the debate by saying to Senator Quayle at the time, he said, I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy. Okay, that was a soundbite that everybody picked up on. Well, ClimateGate was no Watergate. And I think the media then and still bestow the term ClimateGate and everything gate, Himalaya gate, everything gate, much too freely. You got to be really bad to deserve a gate suffix. And I don't think the media have passed the test on that. I think they let them get away with it. It was an initial case of branding, which carried on. So I think that's one of the biggest criticisms. I think now everybody realizes, a lot of the veteran reporters on this beat realize that it wasn't as big a brouhaha as it initially appeared it might have been, and it certainly didn't undercut the science. But the horse was out of the gate at that point. So I think they failed that first early and critical test.
Yeah, it's interesting. That doesn't apply just to the science media. The gatification of every pseudo-scandal in the media today is just so frustrating. It happens really everywhere. Tom?
Well, I guess sort of in keeping with asking for a little media criticism, a little broader than that, you know, with all the erosion of journalism, layoffs, the decline of the business model, all this sort of political economy, things that happen to journalism, you know, what is your assessment of just overall assessment of climate coverage these days? I mean, has it gotten worse? Has it gotten better? Broad assessment?
It's disappeared, in my opinion. I think that's the first thing to point out. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, you know, a few groups have charted climate coverage, both on television and in print, over the last 6-7 years or so. And, you know, you clearly see it gaining momentum from 2005, 2006, reaching its zenith in 2007 again with Katrina, the IPCC report, and Inconvenient Truth. These were all really easy news pegs for reporters to work with. And since then, it's really just been a fairly steady decline in the quantity of coverage. I'm not talking about quality at the moment. There was a small spike around the time of the Copenhagen Climate Conference, sponsored by the United Nations. There was a lot of expectations built up behind that meeting. And led to a concomitant rise in coverage. There was also ClimateGate, unfortunately, and I keep using that term, which is I shouldn't, was wrapped up in a lot of that Copenhagen coverage, which was unfortunate. But since then, you know, and especially with the kind of lit down, I think that Copenhagen really was, editors have just kind of grown a bit disinterested, frankly, in this story. It's difficult for reporters to find new pegs, new ways to frame this story. It's kind of...
There are a couple of, I mean, when you talk about climate coverage, there are two things. One is the coverage of the science. The other is the coverage of the sort of broader political and social reaction and so forth. The science proceeds incrementally, like science always does, I think. And science writers cover it, and, you know, where they have outlets, it's reported and so forth. The sort of political story, or the stories about the political and social and economic implications, I think are really sort of a mess. And part of the problem is that I don't think these stories will ever really change anybody's mind. We had somebody at the Science Writers meeting a couple of years ago, a guy from Yale, who was talking about people's sort of deep personality sort of settings, you know, like people who believe in a more hierarchical kind of society versus an egalitarian society. Paradoxically, those who believe in a hierarchical kind of society are more likely to mistrust scientific experts and believe political figures and so forth. And he used, you know, as an example, attitudes about smoking, which have changed dramatically from the 60s, but it's the 2010s, you know, it's 40 or 50 years to get that to happen. So I think the science coverage, you know, moves along at a nice steady pace, and for those who follow that, it's perfectly fine, most of it. But this political stuff is a mess, and you know, there are way too many sort of general assignment people who encounter this and repeat platitudes or falsehoods or, you know, kind of blanket statements about what people believe or what they think is background that's just wrong because they haven't reported it. One person you might want to check out, who's another figure in our little universe here, is Chris Mooney, if you don't know him, who wrote The Republican War Against Science several years ago. And he blogs now on the Think Progress site, which is a progressive. I think the blog is called Science Progress or something. Anyway, Chris Mooney covers a lot of the political stuff, climate, and you know, keeps a running kind of tally of what's going on.
Yeah.
Just a quick follow-up. I mean, you guys are talking about mainstream coverage, but meanwhile, you know, there's just been an explosion of communication on the subject through blogs, laid off. You know, journalists who are now blogging.
Yeah.
So, what about
that? Well, I mean, I'm sort of including that in my in my comments. There are a bunch of them out there. You know, Andy Revkin being one of the most prominent, who you know, sort of still has the New York Times imprimatur on his blog, but is not making, I don't think, nearly what he made when he was on the staff at the Times. But, you know, he does a great job. He's one of the most prominent ones. There are a lot of them. I mean, there's also a whole world that you may have encountered that seems to me to be sort of emerging, popping up like mushrooms everywhere, which these so-called science bloggers, most of whom are people with a scientific background, who have now gotten into blogging and who pursue a lot of different facets of these things that, you know, in a kind of more minute way that we might not follow. But, it's fairly easy to get tied into that network. And, you're right, there's a vast amount of coverage, and a lot of it is quite good, although... When you, this is beyond your question a little bit, but you see people who come up from science and blog, it's not, much of it is not journalism the way those of us who came up through journalism think about it. They very much take advocacy positions, they're very enthusiastic about science, all kinds of things that they display that are different from the kind of skeptical approach that many of us have been trained in.
I was going to say that probably the pattern of decline, it's been the same in the Spanish-speaking world. The only region that is maybe it's increasing the coverage in climate change is Central America. since it was a region that was declared as one of the most vulnerable in the world. And precisely last week there were these big rains in Salvador and other places, and all news, all stories were associated with climate change, indicating that this is an effect of climate change. So there's this criticism to be done there. But yeah, in Central America, the word climate change is more present maybe in the media now than a few years ago.
Well, what's a good place to cover that from, or to observe that from? Like Tier America, for example? Or how would you follow that coverage? How would you suggest we could follow that coverage in Central America?
It's complicated because there is nothing that... it's like real countries isolated one from the other, so there is no service that gathers all the information. I would say follow the night tracker. No. But no, what I do is to, I would love to have a website that I could follow. I have all these RSS feeds from different newspapers. Tierra America covers a lot of things. Yeah. I follow Tierra America also. But at the end, I don't know if it's very totally well with Costa Rica, with La Nación, they are very well connected, but I don't know with other places. For example, Panama. I need to go there to their newspapers. There is nothing. Yeah,
that's wonderful.
And actually, hold on. I'll take Dan's question just a second. I just wanted to pick up on something Perry said about the rains. I think one of the dominant angles right now is extreme weather and climate change. You probably see more stories about that, perhaps, than on any other kind of climate-related angle. You know, with good reason. I mean, people have always been into stories, you know, that are kind of backyard in nature that really affect them. I mean, that's why we saw such a huge spike in climate change after Katrina. But you know, with the kind of crazy weather events we've been having over the last couple of years, those types of stories have been really, really popular. Unfortunately, not all of the coverage has been very good. It's really kind of difficult to sort out the connection between extreme weather and climate. You know, not to mention the fact that, you know, it depends on whether you're talking about hurricanes versus tornadoes versus fires. You know, each one is a little bit different. So, Dan? If you could introduce yourself, I haven't really been enforcing that, but
Dan. So those of us who are the professors in the room know that we spend a lot of our time critiquing, you know, our students and also professional work, because it's an incredibly useful teaching tool. And you all, you know, take that a step further through the sort of public shaming aspect, which can be incredibly useful. Shaming is a little strong, but you know, the idea of sort of saying, look, this is a problem. But what I found when I'm in my constant critique of love is that two things occur to me, especially now, given the realities of journalism. Number one, I think, God, am I really kicking this guy when he's down? Because we all know that there's incredible pressure to do more with less, and we also know that everyone is a critic, not just we professionals, but also, you know, everyone on the web feels obligated to give their opinion of that coverage, whether it's an educated opinion or not. So I often feel like I'm piling on, and the second thing is that it often occurs to me, wow, you know, good content is scarcer than ever, and here I am adding more criticism. You know, in a world where there's more criticism, then the ratio between criticism and content is shifting in a serious way. So those are two things that sort of mitigate against professional critics or, you know, really wanting to hammer journalism, even as incredibly useful as it is, and a wonderful director just about journalism. So how do you guys deal with it? And does it occur to you that, and you know, how has it changed what you do? Perhaps it's why CJR gives more laurels than berries these days. I don't know.
Yeah, I could say something about that. I have to say, unlike some of my colleagues up here, I give more darts than laurels, and that may just mean I'm a sour and unpleasant character. But I have kind of a flexible number of posts that I put on the tracker every week. And, you know, the things that cause me to stop what I'm doing and write a post on the tracker for something when I really don't have time to do it are the outrages that I see. You know, so I see something, I say, you know, I have to say something about this. I really think it's wrong. And I, to tell you the truth, don't tell anybody outside this room, but I have to sort of remind myself sometimes to stop and look for good stuff and highlight some of the good things. I mean, again, I don't know, it might be my ornery personality, but what I hope it is, you know, a real serious regard for journalism and what we try to do. I've got a lot in, like a lot of you, I got a lot invested in this. I've been doing this for a long time. And the more that you know, people are down or financial things are tricky or people are being laid off and all that stuff, the more reason to uphold standards as far as I'm concerned. The tricky thing is, you know, as I mentioned before, writing for a foundation, which is something that is a relatively new thing and a lot of people are getting involved in that. Writing, spending some of your time writing journalism and some of your time writing PR stuff, which a lot of people do. And there's a lot of gray areas now that are, you know, worth thinking about and paying attention to. But in terms of, you know, good journalism is good journalism and bad is bad. And I don't think it's an excuse. If somebody got laid off, that's not an excuse for them to do a crummy job.
And yeah, it may be one of the reasons CGR has been a little bit more positive. I do often, you know, I'm criticizing the other media critics out there. You know, somebody bashes the media unfairly, and I say, wait, hold on a minute now. You know, this really wasn't such a bad report. And, you know, this person who's attacking this journalist is really coming from a point of view and has a certain political agenda here. So, yeah, that could be. It does exert that pressure, I think, yeah.
I just wanted to note that there are another set of critics out there. They're the academic critics. These are the folks who do scholarly research on media content analysis and so on. Nobody reads us except other academics, so we don't hurt very many people when we criticize one way or the other. But there are some really fine journals out there like Science Communication,
yes.
Public Understanding Science, Risk Analysis, a whole bunch of them. That look at media coverage and do it from a longer perspective, longitudinal studies with data analysis. So there's it. And it's a little industry for those of us who do science and environmental journalism and have to publish. And so that's one thing. I'd like to ask a question, however, and that is related to the science topic, and that's Fukushima and the radiation in particular. In the U.S. publications about radiation issues and the science of what was going on. Has anybody looked at that, done dark circles?
Yeah, I wrote a fair amount about that. I mean, the radiation scares following that incident were unbelievable. I think the most egregious example was what's her name, Nancy Grace at CNN. She's reporting on the state of California, you know, and California had issued some kind of state of emergency, minor state of emergency, just warning that a little bit of storm surge was coming in from that earthquake traveling across the Pacific, and, you know, it knocked a few boats off their moorings up and down the coast of California. So it was just saying, watch out. Well, Nancy Grace basically misunderstood this completely and thought that the state of emergency was being declared because of a cloud of radiation was going to be floating over the Pacific and contaminating food and water supplies all across the western part of the country. So, you know, risk reporting is a huge problem in science journalism in general. People, I think a lot of reporters don't understand, you know, the fundamentals of risk, you know, that you have to, you know, there has to be a danger, there has to be exposure. There are lots of things that make up risk. So I've had a few columns from a guy named David Ropick, who is actually a little bit of a controversial figure because he often, you know, thinks people are overestimating risk, which honestly is often the case. But so we've published a few articles at CJR just trying to outline some of the basic tips for risk reporting. I think that's really important, not only in incidents like Fukushima, but you know, from flame retardants to other kinds of environmental toxics. It's really important to understand the fundamentals of risk reporting. I don't know. Well, you know, if you judge by Fukushima, it's certainly not getting any better. Yeah, no, there was some good stuff out there.
I could add a quick comment that I think touches on points that Sharon made and Dan made, and actually Tom also. A bit about scholarly publications, Sharon. One of Tom's colleagues in Boulder, Max Boykoff, has now published a book called Who Speaks for the Climate? It's just out this week in the United States. And it brings together a lot of his research into media and climate over the past several years. It doesn't look forward, it looks back. As a matter of fact, one criticism I have, or one concern I have, is it doesn't tell us if there's, with this fall off in public awareness, support, call it what you want, about climate change, it doesn't tell us whether or not there's any media connection, either media as a factor in it or media reflecting it. One thing to look out for in the future, I think, is this. I think there's a potential that the mass circulation media, such as they are, will revert to having to go through the same learning curve that everyone in this organization went through several years ago on balance does not equal accuracy. So as you get more thinning of the newsrooms, you know, a one-time great newspaper like the Los Angeles Times just canned, I believe, their last real environment report, Margaret Roosevelt, in Los Angeles. So a great newspaper like the LA Times doesn't have anybody covering this right now and no plans to. And I think the general assignment reporters who are coming in and suddenly being told to go out and cover something like the Mueller report that was referred to earlier have this enormous learning curve to go through. And I think there's a real risk we're going to see a return to balance is bias, call it what you want, as general assignment reporters replace the veteran, wise, and higher salary, approaching pension, all those issues. I don't know why they can't. But as they replace those in newsrooms, I'm concerned we're going to see a whole repeat of that learning curve. So I think that would be one thing to look after. But Boykoff's book does try to move. And I don't think Boykoff's book will get great reviews from the professional psychological or science, social science academy. What he basically did is translate that to a lot to a much more of a lay audience in this new book. But it's an effort to bridge that gap, I think, and a worthwhile one.
Lisa?
So it's a follow-up of Bud's...
And could you just introduce yourself real quick?
Lisa Palmer, pretty nice. Following Bud's point that he made, I have my question for Paul and Curtis and Bud. What is the role of like an environmental journalism deep dive for these new reporters covering the environment? And, you know, who's doing it and who's doing it well? Is there anything out there for them?
You talking about kind of news sites, or?
Yeah,
science,
I mean, suddenly a general assignment reporter is turned into a deep, and how are they able to get to the scene? Besides just, I mean, what tools do they have?
Well, there are a few guides out there. Bud wrote an excellent book on, you know, a guide. What was the title, Bud?
Covering Climate.
Covering Climate. Oh, a simple title. Yeah, there you go. you know, SEJ's publishes guides. The National Association of Science Writers publishes guides. There are quite a few instructive things out there. You know, I'd have to look it up. But I was recently contacted. contacted by the Reuters Institute for Journalism at Oxford University with the same question: what kind of resources are out there for climate change reporters in particular? And I gave there are at least half a dozen guides to climate change reporting that are, I think, really top notch. Unfortunately, there aren't as many for other subjects. I think, you know, environmental toxicology and things like that that are really important subjects. You know, they're not the mega stories, so they don't get the, you know, people don't produce these tip sheets for reporters, unfortunately. So it's pretty tough, you know. I would say one of the great things in the industry today, one of the bright spots, is there are all kinds of fellowships, seminars, workshops, symposia that you can participate in, you know, from the Metcalf Institute to IJNR, to Scripps Institute down in San Diego. A lot of these come with financial support for the journalists who apply, so I would encourage anybody looking for a little bit of additional training to go out for one of those.
I want to put quick Bibles, though, to address Lisa's question. The SEJ listserv, I mean the SEJ site, and the piece that Joe Davis did on climate change is a great resource, and, you know, it should be a must-stop. Tom Uelsman did a spectacular piece for Pointer, which is still online, for training for journalists covering climate science. It should be essential reading for any journalist going into this field. So those two, if you just go to those two, you have a great start. I'll go back to skepticalscience.com out of Brisbane, Australia. This is a site that's 4 years old. It's been done by a 38-year-old guy in his pajamas after working his day job. This site is getting 500,000 unique hits a month in 22 different languages. If you do nothing else, just look at their debunking myths. So if you need a place to debunk some of the myths, you know, it's the sun, CO2 is good for you, all the myths, go to skepticalscience.com and just check their FAQs. It's a Bible. And real climate is, in many ways, almost as good.
Yeah, and I should say CJR is actually working on some grant proposals right now. One of the things we'd like to add to our site are some reporters' toolboxes on different subjects, because I think there really is a need for those kinds of guides. We had a question in the back right here.
I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
So to follow up on that.
Introduce yourself, if you would.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm Wendy Hessler from Environmental Health Sciences, and we publish both The Daily Climate and Environmental Health News. So I just want to make a plug for our archive. One thing that we tell reporters is to come to the archive. We have 300,000 stories archived from the last 10 years, and you can get up to speed on what's been published in the mainstream media by doing a search in our archive, and in 5 minutes you'll have, I think you've got, you know, 10,000 articles that may have been written on environmental health and climate. So I just wanted to plug that in.
Yeah, and I'll second that. Really a great resource. And there's also a media criticism section on the EHN, which is great.
I was going to say that's I actually do that.
Okay.
I run the program with the science program, the Science Communication Doubles Program. And I wanted to ask the panel. So we put up our little reviews, and they're written by scientists. And I get back sometimes from reporters their defense of, you know, why they couldn't do what we asked for, what they were sort of criticized about. And we don't have a way to put up their comments. And I follow some of your sites, but do you offer reporters a way to, do you offer a place where you can have their comments so that they can go back and forth with you? So that the public can see, you know, like a reporter will say, well, that was cut by the editor, or, you know, I had it in there, but they took it out, and I only have so much space, and those kind of, you know, things.
Yeah.
Or even sometimes even more than that.
Right.
Do you have mechanisms for that?
Yeah, Perry. I think the tracker does a good job.
Yeah, the tracker offer the section when, I mean, you can comment on the every story that we do on the tracker, and in fact there is a lot of follow up. Then maybe on private. In fact, a very brief story. I wrote a post like 1 month ago about it's not environment, but it's kind of funny, about a Chilean astronomer that said that Adam Rice and Kirchner, the ones that discovered the acceleration of the universe, used data that they have published before in Chile, something like that. So I wrote that, and Adam Rice is the person that won the Nobel Prize 2 weeks ago. so comment on the tracker, saying, "Hey, you know, it's good that we use some data, but we share the data." So and the Mario Hamui, that's the Chilean astronomer, comment on the tracker again, saying, "No, that's not. In fact, and you can follow. It's in English, so you can read that." And then I exchange emails with Adam Rice, and I visit him privately last August. I published a story in my column in El País, and then he won the Nobel Prize, so it was kind of a nice story.
Yeah, I gotta say, I really admire the tracker's ability to. They're really great comments below a lot of your posts, and I'm not sure exactly how the tracker's been able to pull that off. We haven't at CJR, we just have the worst commenters in the world. They're really bad, they don't add anything, and I mostly ignore them. I don't know if it's because the tracker's got a non-anonymity policy, which I think is really great, and maybe that encourages a higher level of conversation. That would be key. I'd love to see that at CJR, but I haven't been able to win over the editors on that idea. So, another.
Yeah, we have comments. We've been using Keith Clore. Some of you may know him or of him. Did Kaleidoscape and still does Kaleidoscape. Very provocative. We introduced a new blog section, and he's getting tons of comments and traffic. I haven't told Keith this yet, but it's really interesting because, Keith and I are in a four-month experiment on whether this blog thing fits into our format. And there are in this world Keith Clore lovers, and there are in this world Keith Clore detractors. And it's really interesting. Pardon me?
Maybe in this room.
Yeah, I'm looking at one. It's real interesting. This is what I haven't told Keith yet. Because we track subscriptions, people signing up and canceling our RSS. And both have gone up substantially in the time that we've been using Keith. And I don't think it's a cause and effect. I don't know enough to say it's cause and effect. But we're getting a lot more hits, a lot more RSS subscribers with Keith on our site. We're also getting more cancellations than we'd previously gotten. And it's very hard, given the emails which identify the cancellation, to know the quality, if you will, of who's canceling in many cases. But we've started doing a lot more of that, and I think it's been healthy.
But I happen to be Twitter messaging with Keith right now. I don't know if you
want to. Tell him it's all off the record.
Great. Any question?
Yeah. I wanted to ask all panelists whether we are doing a good enough job in the press of facing what I would call reckless misuse of statistics that the climate deniers use in the United States and probably some other countries. Are we getting to the point where we're just putting blinders up and trying to forge ahead and doing a good job covering the climate? Should we be in dialogue with these people more?
I think most of these dialogues are a waste of time. I just don't think they're going to amount to much. There's so many ways, either in writing or conversation or anything, to sort of go back and forth with these things. I don't think the climate story in its sort of basic form is very complicated. I think it's pretty easy, and there are several different lines of evidence that all point in the same direction. You can lay it out in about 5 minutes. Nevertheless, people, people who want to deny or be skeptical or something, it's very easy to plunge into all kinds of detail and find all kinds of spurious arguments and muddy the picture so much that you can't have a conversation. So I frankly think the best thing to do is carry on with good reporting, hope that, based on nothing, I guess, but hope that, good information will eventually, over time, I think, good information displaces bad information, but it can be a long time. But I think to try to engage, it's worthwhile to point out,
How do you think the press is handling that problem? Are we doing a good enough job of getting the good information out in a good way? Are we too distracted by that?
I think the science writer types who intersect with the environmental writer types, I think do a reasonably good job of following the journals and what's in Science and Nature and the big stories in terms of science. And I think that's good, and I think that's important. I think that's, I mean, I would vote for more of that and less of the engaging. You know, if the engaging is going to take time away from covering what's actually happening, I think that's probably not a good strategy. But it's hard to know for sure.
Yeah, it's tough. I go back and forth on this question, the extent to which the media should be, in a sense, fighting back against the abuse of statistics and other forms of misinformation. I guess I would tend to agree with Paul. I would say that it's worth engaging when that abuse of statistics and misinformation kind of reaches the highest levels. A lot of it happens kind of in the niches, it seems like. And, you know, I don't think guys like Mark Morano honestly have much effect on the American public writ large, you know. So, you know, if he's, you know, throwing out his latest spin, I don't think it's really worth the media's time to rebut him. It's when that kind of BS reaches a kind of higher prominence, you know, through some, you know, if he's able to get himself quoted in the Washington Post or something like that, then, you know, it's worth the media maybe pushing back a little bit. Otherwise, yeah, I would kind of tend to agree with Paul. It's best to just leave them to their little tiny dark universes. And
I think there's also a temptation to sort of dismiss these, you know, it, not so much in the bigger media outlets, but on the blogs, to, you know, describe these people as idiots, know-nothings, you know, all captive of Exxon, or pick your favorite, you know, dumb thing. And I don't think that's, I think that's even less useful. I mean, I don't know what their motivations are. That's a subject of inquiry if somebody wants to pursue it. That's yet, again, another level removed. But, you know, to dismiss them all as people who are stupid or ignorant is not usable, I don't think.
Agreed, yeah. Yeah, mudslinging contests aren't terribly productive.
You know, none of the people who went to journalism school in my generation went there because they wanted to study or learn statistics or numbers or physics. You know, we went there because we didn't have to take those kinds of classes. So I think one of the first things I think would be the journalists need not necessarily go out and critique them, take them on, but they should understand statistics. I once had a foundation grant, small foundation grant, to distribute, mostly to SEJ members, a little Bible. I think it's still a Bible. It was called News and Numbers. It was by Victor Cohn, who was one of the first and one of the great science reporters. Went from the Detroit News to Free Press to New York Times to Washington Post, the late Victor Cohn. But if journalists wanting to understand statistics would only read Chapter 8 of News and Numbers, they would come up with a level of understanding that dwarfs what most of them probably currently have. And that would put them in a good position to address that kind of issue or ignore it.
There's a new third edition just out.
Great.
I think we have time for just one more quick question. You've had one, so yeah. If there's one other person in the audience, if not... That's true. Yeah, they've got the radio shows. In his role in EPW, the Environmental Public Works Committee, I think he wielded more clout. I've always been interested in why he left that position and what happened there, and that's never really been covered. I don't know. Maybe he is having a wider influence than I give him credit for, but... perhaps, yeah. We don't. I certainly don't pay enough attention to AM radio or television news. You know, for a lot of reasons, it's just much easier to track what's happening in print. But and there aren't the kind of services like LexisNexis and Factiva that allow us to. But I agree. The radio and television punditry out there is pretty bad, and it's something we could all probably spend more time addressing. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Quick comment, then we got to wrap this up. Okay.
That was quick.
Great. That was quick. Yeah.
How do you spell
it? Yeah, very true. Okay, just a bit of housekeeping. I was asked to remind you, beginning immediately after this session at the news podium, the chief of the U.S. Forest Service, Tom Tidwell, will discuss the service's new proposed planning rule. The planning rule will govern the management of all our national forests. Over 300,000 public comments have been received on how the rule will impact the environment, the timber industry, and the recycling industry. So, far side, please join me thanking our panelists, and thank you again for coming.